This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And thank you very much for joining us today for a live end of 2017 overview, free-for-all, whatever we want to make it, chat fest. And just a reminder to those esteemed colleagues that are joining us live, if you scroll to the bottom of the page, you can roll in with some of the usual suspects in the chat room, because we do have kind of an open mind, open format today. If you have some subjects you'd like us to chatter about, that's a good place to put it in. Of course, our friends are always welcome to call in if they'd like on shows like today. The switchboard is area code 347-308-8397, right there on the show page, as it always is. But again, the show play page, we already have Lee, Paul, and Chris in there, not being as snarky as usual, but that's okay. But hey, want to go ahead and kick into it. And I want to start off, as most of the regulars know, we are winding up our seventh year here on Midrats, where my co-host and I think we look at ourselves as maybe the McNeil Lair of the Navy side of the house. Maybe we're closer to Siskel and Ebert or Stadler and Waldorf from the Muppet Show. I'm not sure where we are, but it's been an amazing 7 years. And as we rolling up on 2018, I just said, hey, Eagle One, you've been a great partner in crime here on the show, and it's been a pleasure for the last 7 years. I look forward to more.
It's been a lot of fun. I thank you for letting me be on your show, Sal.
It's our show. I just do the intro. And also want to thank the regulars we've had through the years. A lot of the guests that we've had have come from hints and suggestions from our regular listeners, who they said, hey, I really like for you to have so-and-so on their show. And a lot of times I go, well, I don't know how to get in touch with them. They say, well, I do. And then we've been able to have on just some of the tremendous guests that we've had. We've also had people who have been with us as regular guests for almost the last 7 years, whether we're talking about Claude or Brian or McKenzie. It's always been a pleasure to have those on a regular basis. And of course, some of our really specialist guests, Dimitri Gornberg. We've had Dimitri on about at least six times, I think. And we had Dr. Gornberg on before everybody else thought Russia was cool. I think we had him on our first year, didn't we?
Yeah, I think probably because of your NATO experience. You know, Russia always loomed larger than in your thoughts, I think, than in some others earlier. But yeah, it's I looked at our list of shows this year alone. You know, global naval power, fixing the war colleges, the collision between the McCain and Fitz collisions. Fitzgerald, yes. Man, we've Hezbollah, Navy in crisis, the Asiatic fleet in 1941, migrants, Thucydides, carrier building, the size of the Navy, tactics, Russia. U.S. is an indispensable nation, and the effects of that, ISIS, China and cyber, Westpac stuff, Jackson's Navy. We've covered a lot of stuff, and that's pretty, to me, that's pretty impressive. It was fun going back and look over the list.
Yeah, see, I feel sorry for those that find themselves bored or uninterested in the world, because there's a lot out there. I think another thing that's kind of nice about our show is occasionally I'll put our friend so-and-so. But we do have people that in many ways may have outgrown Midrats, but they still come on a regular basis. And Jerry Hendricks is a perfect example. He would call in back in the first year, and then we have him on as a guest. And, of course, I've known Jerry for a very, very long time. And so that's just my kind of shout out to our regular guests and our loyal listeners that really make the show a pleasure. I was thinking about what to talk about today. It's one of those things. How do you collapse it all into an hour? And one thing that kept popping up in the back of my mind is something that we've talked about during its existence, but at the end of 2017, especially 18 months ago, if you told somebody this would take place, a lot of people wouldn't have believed it or wouldn't have believed how efficiently we got to that point. And I think one of the most underappreciated stories of 2017 is the elimination of the Islamic State Caliphate as a geographical land-holding entity in both Syria and Iraq. You almost hear very little, if anything, about what was an above-the-fold significant global national security challenge. Of course, their terrorism isn't going anywhere, but we really, when you look at their strategic center of gravity, which, as we've talked here, has always been considered the religious underpinnings for their existence. You take away the caliphate, you've just done a tremendous damage to their organization. So I'm happy to wind up 2017, perhaps not having at least that particular geographical area of the topic being a subject of discussion.
Yeah, I think that you're right. The caliphate is gone, but the price that we are going to pay for that, I don't think has been invoiced to us yet. I mean, we've got Iran heavily involved now in an area of the world that they're very interested in. We've got, there's a whole bunch of other little things going on there, which, some of which are fairly major given the region. I mean, Russia is cementing its relationship with Syria. They're going to expand that port at Tartarus, whatever the name of that town is. They're going to be involved there. They've got to get the warm water port, maybe a bigger warm water port. We've got other stuff going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran with the proxy war they're fighting in Yemen, including as the U.S. showed the other day, the Iranian missiles being used to attack Saudi Arabia. So, I think we talked about this before the show slightly, is that what I see, a bunch of regional hegemons beginning to assert their power. So you've got Russia, you've got China trying to dominate Southeast Asia, we've got Iran trying to dominate Southwest Asia, and then we have a bunch of other messy little things going around the world that we probably ought to talk about in the future. So it's been interesting, and it's going to be interesting over the next year or so, I think. So we got plenty to talk about. I really liked your recent piece that you wrote on Africa and the mess that it is, and it's not limited to sub-Saharan Africa or the northern part of Africa, but the whole place is a wreck.
It goes back to, everybody likes to, I'm easily distracted by the shiny little object of, this ship or that ship, this capability, this inside the beltway, intral reading. But there are some real meta macro movements going on the globe that perplexing, I don't think, is a strong enough word. Is there's just this combination of macro factors that throughout human history have driven huge changes. And you're seeing them all focusing in on Africa. You've got the fact you have an incredibly fast-growing population that does not have a comparable growing economic system to sustain on a per capita basis a modern standard of living. You have the bleeding edge of Islam in the Sahel that is folding in with the ongoing conflicts that you see on the edge of wherever Christian and animist societies or Buddhist societies come in contact with Islam. All these factors are coming together, and something's got to give. it's not going to be, well, history is never static, but when you get these high pressure points, there's not the options there had been in the past. In Europe after 1848, those internal pressures in a large part were relieved by mass immigration from Germany and following that Italy and other locations to North America and South America. The European countries are already crowded and there's no desire on their part to import tens of millions of Africans. The Islamic world definitely isn't going to do it, and you're not going to see China or India do it anytime soon either. So the pressures are going to be contained there. What direction it goes in, I don't know. But all the ingredients are there for it to not be contained, because China has a lot of new economic ties, not just in Africa, but you can see as they try to reestablish where they were a few hundred years ago. I found one of the more interesting parts, not directly related to Africa, but it is indirectly related, and I think we're going to see it replicated elsewhere. Over in Sri Lanka, they handed over, and I can't pronounce it, but I think it's Hambantota port to the Chinese on a 99-year lease. And I think those that have a schoolboy's reading of China, at least on my part, I got kind of a grin on that, because that's how the Brits got Hong Kong, was via that 99-year lease. And that was at the nadir of Chinese power. And I know if I was Chinese, I would not just pass by the fact that we just signed a 99-year lease on a port with a shrug of the shoulders. It would be interesting to see how they replicate that down the road.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of other countries that have signed up for China aid that are looking at that going, uh-oh. And plus, China's throwing its weight around. I mean, they have directly told the Australians, basically back off. Don't criticize us. And judging by the number of investigations going on in Australia about the influence, and New Zealand too, for that matter, about the influence of the Chinese government against some of the political politicians, that's ugly, and that's, and I, you know, and I'm questioning, of course, as we all should all the time as American citizens, what is our role in the world? Are we going to continue to try and dominate the protection of the sea lanes for the world's commerce, or is it incumbent on us to do that, or is it time to kind of cut back a little and see how some of these events are going to play out? Because I question what our intentions are toward China in the South China Sea area. And I know all the countries around the South China Sea are wondering what we're going to do too, because we're not making a super strong stand there. And the way we're treating our freedom of navigation operations, it's like a once a year birthday party for somebody. It's not really an ongoing event, at least not from where I'm sitting, which is admittedly not in the frontal lobes of the powers that be.
And I know I'm kind of in some respects out there an island to myself in this regard, and of course I've believed this pre 9/11 within reasons. I have no problem with additional global disengagement. It's not 1949 anymore. It's not 1969 anymore. It's not 1989 anymore. It's coming up on 2018, and we can't make other nations love their liberty more than they do. We can't make them love their liberty if they don't want to. We should back up our friends and allies, but I don't think that we should be their tripwire. The Australians and the New Zealanders, they are small nations, but they've got the luxury of geography and the rule of law. They need to be cautious about the Chinese. It's very interesting. I've read a couple of articles about what's happening with the bribery and the influence operations there. that if people don't think that's going on here in the U.S. as well, they're not thinking right. There are lots of authoritarian nations, and the ironic being the most mercantilist nation now, China, is also run by a communist party, but that's just a power play. That we should be in a position to help our friends and to let them know we're going to back up, but we shouldn't be doing what they should be doing themselves. If the South China Sea is so bloody important to the Filipinos, the Japanese, the Vietnamese, the Australians, and the New Zealanders, they really need to take the point on it, and we should back their play. But I am always very concerned that we overextend ourselves, assuming that we have the power differential we once have. We don't. Or that we are minutes away from a large-scale war someplace. We aren't. But the further that we're out there in places that maybe we're not really designed to be, I think the odds of a mistake or a misreading are even larger. And I know there are good people that do think that we should be positioned as a guarantor of the global peace as some type of benign global empire. But large global empires who also happen to be up to their ears in debt usually don't end real well. So it's not historically a good combination or position for us to be in, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, we are a Pacific power. We've got with Alaska, Hawaii, Guam and the other territories we have out there, we do belong in that part of the world. And, we have a huge amount of commerce going with China, Japan, and some of the other countries there. But I'm just curious as to whether we are not Britain dependent on our colonies or our Commonwealth countries for wealth and all that, and that having their for to maintain a very large navy, which the Brits did. Of course, it cost them dearly. But now that they don't have that empire to protect, they're having trouble making ends meet. A lot of it's due to the social welfare benefits that they give to everybody. But they're in a tough bind. The Dutch, they're all these small countries. The Dutch, the Belgians, the Swedes, the Norwegians. I mean, you can name that whole northern and the Italians. You know, they don't have the wherewithal either to do the worldwide stuff. But, is that required? Or is what I'm saying is, are these regional hegemons? And I could go through the list again, but I mean, are we going to say to Iran, if you can do it, but you've got to fend off the Saudis and the Iraqis should they choose to rise up. And where is Turkey going to end up in this stuff? Because they seem to be veering rapidly away from their NATO commitments and getting closer to the Russians and perhaps the Iranians.
I think what will be interesting in Turkey is how long this movement and this really sad and unfortunate direction that they've gone in the last couple of decades, especially the last decade, how long it'll survive Erdogan. It's one thing to rebuild the Sultanate, but if you don't have a hereditary monarchy, you turn into something else. I don't know, but you brought up Saudi Arabia a bit, and that's one of the big known unknowns that I'm looking at for 2018 is, yippee-hi-yi-yay, the caliphate's no longer here, but that doesn't mean that the peace is going to break out from the Turkish border down to Aden. The saber rattling between the Saudis, who are basically want to lead the Sunni world, and the Iranians, brings back that Arab-Persian conflict that goes back throughout written history. And one of the interesting angles on that is you have the Sunni-led but majority Shia kingdom of Bahrain, who, like Saudi Arabia, are getting closer and closer to Israel, because Israel sees Iran and their proxies like Hezbollah, now that Egypt is no longer a threat, as their greatest existential threat. I think it was the Crown Prince who said recently, you know, Israel and Saudi Arabia have never been at war with each other, and we have no reason to be. We don't see them as the enemy. Kind of setting the ground. There were some reports over the weekend that Bahrain might be the one of the first nations in the Gulf to establish diplomatic relations with Israel. And it'll be interesting to watch how Iran responds to this, because they're not weak. They've gotten stronger. The Iran nuke deal at the closing days of the Obama administration's greatly increased their hand. Their success in helping to defend Assad from the Islamic State has enhanced their street cred. They got a little bit of alliance with Russia when it's convenient, as all alliances with Russia are. So there's no reason for the Iranians to be coy or go into the background, and neither is there for the Saudis. How we would get in between them, I have no idea. Could it happen? Sure, but I don't think it's something we won't have anything to do with.
Yeah, it's a really interesting challenge. And if you're Bahrain, they do a lot of business with the Iranians. Recognizing Israel would be a huge step for them, and I wonder what the economic impact would be of that. You know, Lee is talking about the globalization as a fact. We don't empires are not around anymore. But, you know, globalization operates on the basis of open sea lanes. And if everyone, even the countries we don't like, want the sea lanes open, that really diminishes some of the concerns that the U.S. ought to have about sea lanes. And we're in a very advantageous position in that we can provide now and into the indefinite future our own petroleum and other goods, maybe a little weak on some of the materials used for computers, but we are not as dependent on some aspects of foreign trade as some of these other countries, which are absolutely dependent. If China's foreign trade gets cut off, I would think that their government would undergo a rapid change.
That's one of the reasons I have sympathy and respect for the Chinese and the growth of their navy. Is, you know, pick whatever nightmare scenario you want to, but outside of the economic impact, if the major sea lines of communications, for whatever reason, no longer became accessible, in the Western Hemisphere, we could make do. For our energy, you have the U.S., Canada, Venezuela, if they could ever get rid of their socialist kleptocracy. Mexico, even under a well-rationed system, if even that's more than manageable, nobody here is going to starve to death. Again, Canada, U.S., Mexico, Argentina, nobody's going to get rich, nobody's going to get fat, but you're not going to have widespread starvation under a worst-case scenario. That's not true for China. If all of a sudden China's sea lanes and major land routes came under stress, they cannot energize or feed their, what are they at, 1.25 billion now?
Yeah, it's a big number. Yeah. Well, and that also raises the issue of what China is going to do as people begin to crack down on the illegal fishing conducted by the overseas Chinese fishing fleet. You know, what can't go on won't go on, and people are tired of seeing Chinese ships popping up in their waters, and particularly since much of the the fishing that is done is the kind that does the most damage to the fish stocks. So I think we're in for some interesting times. Maybe not in the coming year, but certainly it's something to keep an eye on as people react. And then there's the great unknowns of India. You know, there's another country with a billion people that is engaged in international commerce, but always seems to be headed in three directions at once, and I can never quite figure out which way they're going.
Yeah, India is kind of like Brazil. Just when you think they've got their traction and are headed in the right direction, then some shambolic activity takes place. And India itself has a lot of cultural issues. They're really many nations welded together into one. They have their regional differences, an order of magnitude than what the American context we might appreciate, but they have a lot of potential, just like the Chinese. And you know, 1,000 years ago, they were something, but they have the same problem the Chinese have as well, is their modern system is fragile. How well could it take a shock? They're a tough people and they have a high tolerance. But if it wasn't for the Green Revolution that took place when I was a pup and even you were a pup back when did the Green Revolution really kick off? Early 60s. If it wasn't for that, that doubled output in the agricultural sector, India and China wouldn't be where they are today, but they still have a very fragile system as far as their ability to sustain themselves. And when you got 1.2 billion versus 1.3 billion, everybody looks to the U.S. to solve problems. I don't think we can solve that problem.
I don't think we ought to get involved in the India. China border disputes, and I don't think we ought to get involved in as much as we can. We need to disentangle ourselves from the Pakistan-India border disputes, which is another one of those intractable challenges.
Generations of American diplomats have tried to fix that problem. You're exactly right. We need to make sure that we're disentangled from that if possible, because all we can do is get ourselves in trouble.
Yeah, and, we're still dealing with the issues of metals, about the earth elements that we need for things, all that. Yeah, that's all international trade, and I think that some of that's going to go on regardless of who is trying to dominate the local or guard the local sea lanes. But the question is, if given our limited budgets, self-inflicted wounds caused by neglect of improving the Navy over the years, and I guess somebody had a vision of what the Navy should look like, and we end up with LCS instead of real ships. And I know that everybody in the LCS community is going, no, we're really good now. We're much better than we used to be. And when do we get those vertical launch systems? I can't wait. But until then, if we had a war where we had to escort merchant vessels, I'm wondering what we would use as escorts. Because if you're looking at the LCS.
We would use what we had available to us. And it would be LCS, and we would be putting ships there who can do 15% of the job that needs to be done because we don't have anything else. The Mike Mullen, Bob Work, if we need frigates, our allies will give it to us, is delusional. It's simply not going to happen. If it does happen, it'll just be there on the margins. And we've seen throughout history that you have to be prepared to do things by yourself if you're the big power, because you'll have circumstances like, let's go back to the Barbary Pirates. People forget that our initial allies in our war against the Barbary Pirates were the Swedes. And the Swedes finally said, after, you know, I think it was a year or this, they said, we're going to go back to the Baltic. Good luck with that. Off of Okinawa in World War II, Canadian cruiser had the crew take a vote after Nazi Germany surrendered. Do we want to stay here and fight the Japanese? And the crew said no, and they went home. If we've got to do some escorts, we'll have to do it with what we have, which means you'll either have LCS out there doing the best they can, or you're going to have a light cruiser, otherwise known as a Flight 2A, or maybe in the future a Flight 3 Arleigh Burke destroyer, doing what should be something half its size and expense doing, because we don't have anything else.
The advantage the LCS has, if there is one, is that it does have helicopters.
Yep.
And you run five or six helos out there, and you can use things like the drones, the larger drones. That, and I'm not sure whether they're, I don't know, their ASW capabilities, but you know, the theory is that they can do that mission, especially with their onboard weapon system being the helicopters. But ASW, I'm sure that when we're talking about improving the quality of our surface warfare ship drivers, one of the things that I know that we haven't spent enough time on is ASW, and I'm not sure how the Hilo community is working on those issues, but we better start gearing up for this stuff, because the challenges don't get easier with these air independent submarines, and we're talking about operations in restricted waters. These things are very tough, and we better be prepared.
And our longtime listeners of Midrats know we've been talking about this for years. There's a little bit of vindication. I want to read something from you. I'm hoping to be able to pull the trigger on a post when I get through reading the strategic readiness review that came out last week. And I this for everybody going into 2018, and I have to give credit. She won't mind me mentioning this. An offline conversation I was having with our friend Mackenzie Eglin, she pointed this out to me and said, hey, look out for this. She gave me this heads up a couple weeks ago, and lo and behold, we see it. From what I've read, and I'm not through with it, I would recommend all the listeners of Midrats go online, get a PDF copy, and if you can't Google and find a PDF copy, send me an email. I'll send you a copy of it. Anyway, get a copy of it comes out to 100 pages, but it says it's 96, 97, something like that. But it's got lots of references. This document is something everybody should be proud of. And there's a little Easter egg when you look at who is leading it. And I'll mention this in my post that I was impressed, and I'll probably owe somebody. I don't know if I owe him an apology, but I owe him a recognition. And he's redeemed himself a bit in my mind, but I won't bring that up here. But let me read this port to you. This is what McKenzie told me to look out for. And it's in the second sentence, beginning of the quote from the executive summary, right off the top rope. The U.S. Navy is without question the most capable in the world, but its primacy is being challenged as it sails into a security environment not seen since before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Another era of, drum roll please, continuing with the quote now, sustained peer-to-peer competition has arrived, and failing to recognize and prepare for its very different challenges will have severe consequences. Peer-to-peer, not near-peer, but peer-to-peer competition. We're going to be seeing a lot more of that talk, and I don't think it's hyperbole. I think it's fair, because as we've talked about through the years, when you get into their near shore environment, we have people like the Chinese and the Russians who are our peer, and in some areas may even be we're the near peer, where they're better than we are. But I think in this document and in other things, the fact that we're now talking that we're back into an era of peer competition, I think will focus the mind. You could argue there's some hyperbole there, but when you actually get into the operational level, no, it's not. I think that's a welcome addition and should bring about a little more clarity of thought and focus of mind. So we've got that going for us.
I think that's important. I mean, we may have the world's premier blue water Navy, but as I think Wayne Hughes points out in his great book, not many wars are fought in the blue water. They're fought near shore, inshore. We have, the LCS was supposed to help with some of those issues, and Lee assures me
right
now that the new ones will be great. We really need to work on it. We need to, because I cannot foresee some, and I always wondered about this. We had that kind of argument once with Bob Work, I think, that it's great to have these big ships that cover more territory than four other ships used to, but you still only got one ship, and we have more missions than one ship can handle. You've got to have presence. You've got to have ships that operate inshore, and you've got to be able to sustain this force. And part of the problem is that Congress has neglected its duty by not having a budget, a consistent military budget. You know, these continuing resolution things and the burden that the Congress has placed on the way we fund our military, you know, it's just killing us. We've got to get over this stuff.
I don't – everything enters with money. I think, you know, that is, at least for me, the entering argument on what I think is the most overhyped story of 2017. And we've talked about it here, and hey, I admit that I was kind of giggly about it as well. And that's the 355-ship Navy. It's not going to happen. There's no money for it. You're not going to see the budgetary support, regardless of how much you justify or try to sell it, for 355-ship Navy. And as you read the strategic review and other results coming from what is increasingly looking like a proper and mature self-evaluation after the incidents in WestPac this year, what additional money we do get is going to be spent fixing the shortfalls of previous years, readiness, manpower, training. That's where the money is going to have to go to old school ways. We're going to have to get out our needle guns, rip off the paint that we put on top of the rust, get down to the rust, prep the metal, and repaint it again, because we're looking at something that's just been painted over. And that's expensive. That's going to take money to do. And at least the near term, I think that's where the money is going to go. We're going into an election year in 2018, and who knows what's going to happen in 2020. But I just do not see, barring any type of global catastrophe, the money for a 355-ship Navy showing up. What the final number is going to be, I don't know, but it's not going to be 355.
Yeah, I think SecNav kind of addressed that. I mean, exactly.
Agreed.
You know, we've got to focus on the things that we need right now. We can always, you know, I guess in theory, we can always build more ships, but we need to go back to basics on training for the surface warfare officers. I was one of those ones who came in before there was Surface Warfare Officer School, but I find it almost unbelievable. These kids are going out there and not getting, I mean, at least I went to some training before I got to the ship on how to, you know the rules of the road and understand radar and all stuff. And apparently these kids are being thrown out there without any of that. And that's just terrible for, you know, I watched what my sons have went through to get through flight school. That's a whole,
yep,
you know, it's a long process, 2 years or so or more of training. And I do not understand why we're not giving these kids going to surface ships 6 months at least of, you know, here's your YP, go drive it around, don't run anything, and learn the rules of the road and test them on all that stuff. It just makes no sense. Maybe we don't do that. And if nothing else, they ought to be going to, a semester or something at one of the maritime academies, Merchant Marine Academies, as because those guys, everyone I've sailed with who was one of those academies, they knew about driving ships.
Yeah. And there's no reason why a surface warfare officer on a bridge should have any less institutional support for their professional development than an aviator. Because as we saw this summer, people say, well, you know, a pilot has got to have a high level because he's flying a $150 million aircraft. And if you don't do it exactly right, they're going to praying in and da-da-da-da-da. Well, you know what? If you have people up on a bridge who don't know how to properly control helm and lee helm, and you wind up getting T-boned by a group three, well, that's pretty important too. I think if we can get past, and I think we're headed this way, which is good. And it's going to cost more money, but that's fine. I would rather have three things that are done well than five things that are done crappy. If we can take the lives of the 17 sailors that were lost this summer and have that catalyst make our surface fleet better than, though we won't know where it is and we won't know who it is, that will save a lot of lives and a lot of treasure down the road. So the loss of their lives won't be in vain. We can recapture some of that sacrifice in a positive direction, which if we have the follow through with what I've seen recently, I think we may do it. There's a reason to be positive going into 2018, at least in that regard. We may not get our 355 ship Navy, but culture is more important than money. If we can get a net positive move in our culture, so the young men and women that are coming in to lead our Navy or to be our sailors are given the tools that they need to be the best they can. Okay, I'll take that. I'll take a 350 ship Navy that has that fix than a 355 ship Navy that does everything like we have before.
Yeah, I think we also need to have Navy leadership tell folks that are demanding naval presence. You know, if we're going to have as you say, 150 ship combat Navy, we have to tell people, look, we can't do all these missions. Somebody's got to prioritize where we're going to. We can't continue this cheery eye and having our young COs taking their ships out, knowing that they can drive the ship around, but they don't have a weapon system or a sensor or something. You know, we've got to be all about readiness and all about quality of the people driving the ships and all about making sure that what we do have is superb. It ought to be the best of all possible worlds. How do you get there? I go back to the days of Deming. I mean, I think we've really got to learn how to use Deming the way that Deming was used by the Japanese and changing their manufacturing culture. But we have to do it unlike the haphazard approach we took when it was introduced to fleet years ago. You really need to drive out fear. You really need to make sure, just take a junior officer, that before that junior officer gets to your ship, you want him to be already of excellent quality. You don't want to have to go. It's the old part thing. You know, the way that the Deming system works is you demand your suppliers give you parts that don't need to be worked on. You know, so that you can just assemble the things and it's going to work. Well, we ought to be doing that with human beings. And in this case, our young officers going to surface ships ought to be coming out of a school, and they ought to be tested before they come out of that school. If they don't make the cut, they lack situational awareness, or they just don't get it, or whatever you want to say, then they should not be allowed to go to sea. And they sure as heck should not be driving ships. And so when they walk on board, though, the CEO of that ship knows he's getting a quality product, and he should not have to be concerned. You're still going to have to qualify him on the ship, but he should not be concerned that this person comes in and knows absolutely nothing. And I've sailed with him, and I'm sure many other people have. There's some guys who will never, and young women who will never get it. And no matter how hard you try, they just don't grasp it. They're the ones who are bad drivers on the highway. They'll be bad drivers in the ocean.
It's not that the thing is, you know what, in life, not everybody gets a trophy. Not everybody can do what they really, really want to do. And that's okay. That doesn't mean they're bad people. Doesn't mean they're stupid people. That doesn't mean they're unpatriotic people or incompetent people. It's just their skill set lies somewhere else. And I've always thought that because of our inability to look somebody in the eye and go, you know what, this just really isn't for you. We appreciate you wanting to serve, and you have served for 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, whatever it is. Your skill set lies elsewhere. We're going to go ahead and separate you from the Navy. And we wish you the best of luck, et cetera, and so forth. We do a great disservice when we don't do that to people because, especially when you're in your 19, the BBC is trying to tell me something. Especially when you're in your 1920s, you don't get those years back. That's a critical time period in your life that is going to set you up for your 30s and your 40s and your follow, your ability, if you so choose to have a family, to get it set up and running and building. And if you're going to spend 3 or 4 years of your 1920s in a military career that you're just not set out to do all because the institution didn't have the moral bravery to tell you this isn't going to work for you, we're not doing anybody any good. And unfortunately, we do that more often than not. And I think you hit a good point. If you get people properly trained up, you're going to have a bottom blow, one would hope, if the training echelons are allowed to do this. And we all have stories, at least I do, of interference, of trying to wash people out for a variety of reasons. Then when they show up on the ship, the skipper, the XO, the department heads, they can give a higher level training. They don't have to tell the guy red to port, green to starboard. They can do some higher level training, develop a better engineer, a better ship driver. And if he's been on board for 6 to 8 months, then it's just ain't going to happen like it used to be in the World War II era. That CO has the ability to go, I'm sorry, ensign, this just isn't made out for you. No harm, no foul. You're getting the next helo out of here. Have a nice day. And they should be supported to do that.
Yeah, and I know squadrons, our air crews of various types. You know, they have instructor pilots attached or training pilots attached to their squadrons, and if the pilot they don't hesitate to suggest that somebody who just doesn't have it leave. You know, I mean, it's probably tough on everybody, but it's a lot better than having that person do a plant into the stern of a carrier, because they really just don't have what it takes to do the job. And so I agree with you. I fail to understand. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was on an oiler. We were doing operations with a Canadian, one of the Canadian AORs or AOEs or something. And the Canadian driving their ship turned the wrong way during an exercise. And, you know, we got into port later on. I said, well, what happened to that guy? They said, we fired him. He's gone. I said, wow, that was pretty well. It's not the first time. So he was on notice. But, you know, that's the kind of you don't have to be ruthless, but you have to be tough enough to do it. If somebody just isn't cutting it, you know, give them fair warning, try and train them up. But if they're really not doing it right, you have to cut them loose.
And it's amazing how, for a variety of reasons, we just don't do that when we should. But you know what? That's people.
Well, Paul just hit it in the chat room. Yeah, that's called having standards. Yes, and that is what we sometimes let slip, and it should not happen. I mean, and it's not, as Sal said, not bad guys. I was on a destroyer with a guy who he couldn't get it. He was a Russian linguist, though, so he went to do Russian linguistics thing, was able to make a career out of it, and that's where he belonged. He did not belong on the deck of a destroyer, and certainly not driving this ship around.
There are things that industry does from an HR perspective that it would be really nice if the Navy could do more of. I know the aviation side of the house does a little bit of this, but it's all after the fact. But out in industry, one of the things that many companies do, because when you hire somebody, there's a huge expense, not just in bringing somebody on board and getting them trained, but if all of a sudden you find out this person can't do their job, you've got a sunk cost of all the training and effort and salary you've done in this individual, and you have the opportunity cost of not hiring somebody better. So a lot of times what they do is they use various personality profile and personality tests, because they know that for a particular job, the following personality types do well 70% of the time. This personality type fails about 90% of the time. So if you're hiring for position X, these personality types are the ones you want to push there. If you want to go to position Y, you go. You look for these type of personality types. Again, it's not 100%, but it is part of the consideration for some positions. And I know the Navy doesn't do that, which is why you see people who are otherwise smart, good, sane people who just are horrible at a certain job, but they'll go leave the Navy and they'll succeed someplace else. It's because the Navy let that type of person do it.
Yeah, I guess the submariners must weed out pretty well.
I think they do.
But I always wonder how U.S. Grant would have done under a test scheme like that. You know, he certainly did well during the Mexican War. Kind of fell on hard times. You know, then went out and failed at all these other jobs. Comes back in and into the Army and kind of makes a success of things.
Yeah. Grant was one of those guys, kind of like Sherman and Sheridan. They were made to be operational level and tactical level combat leaders, and they failed at everything else.
And that's another question. You know, I think some admiral or maybe somebody in proceedings was talking about how we've created a bunch of buck passers and admin weenies or something. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, pretty much, where are the warriors? Where are, you know, how do we, and this is, I'm thinking about your psychological profile. How are we going to identify who the warriors are? Who are the ones you really need when the balloon goes up? And how do we keep them, their interests and stuff? So, you know, if you train up a fighter pilot, one assumes that that guy or young woman is of a different mindset than if somebody just, as usual suspect says in the chat room, a different mindset than somebody who's going to fly P-3s. And you want both types, but you need to be able to sort them out. And I think we need that on the also in the decks of ships. Some people have a almost intuitive grasp of they, you know, they can come in and get the big picture right away. And there are other people who they can't do that. We need to work on that.
I can tell you right now, and I'll play against type and be a little cynical here, but it's cynicism based upon firsthand knowledge. There's also perverse incentives. You get what you incentivize. You look at the results of a lot of the screen boards of the last decade and a half, they have not favored combat experience. They have not rewarded those who have volunteered for deployed level commands. They have rewarded those who took shore, CONUS, staff weenie positions. Therefore, you get what you promote. You promote what you get. So, you know, where are a lot of the warriors? Oh, well, they're doing warrior stuff for a certain length of time, but those aren't really the ones that we're promoting all that much. That's not saying those that we are promoting are bad people. But matter of fact, if the incentive was to get combat experience, then those people would not have positioned themselves to get CONUS-based staff weenie positions. They would have positioned themselves to forward deployed because that's where the incentive was. That's where that comes from.
Some years ago, it might have been when we first started blogging, there was a cut. They were going to cut the size of the various services, and they were they were cutting guys who'd just been to war. And
I'm
thinking, you know, the people that should be cut, I think we wrote at the time, both of us, probably separately, but we both wrote, why are you not cutting those weenies who didn't go to war? You know, I mean, those ought to be the first ones to go. The guy who's filling some ridiculous job in, you know, inspecting turnips or something, he ought to be the guy who is let go. And the guy who just got back from a tour in Afghanistan or Iraq someplace, you know, he ought to be kept around. And
well,
we don't want to lose that in. Go ahead.
I have been told things have not changed since. I distinctly remember, like it was yesterday, in the 2003-2004 time frame, where I was literally told, when we were trying to fill as many IAs that we could to support Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, sending intel officers to run supply depots outside of Basra and stuff like that, we were told, do not send the following people. These are our top runners that we need here to fill staff positions. So even if they volunteer, do not send the following people forward deployed, which clearly sent a signal to everybody that if you got the phone call to go fill one of these, and you know, for you kiddies that don't remember what things were like in 2003, 2004, 2005, go back and educate yourself. When you've got a nation scrambling in two significant conflicts at one time, the message gets out pretty fast that, hey, our front runners aren't going to this position. So if you get the phone call, guess what, shipmate? You're not one of them. And that's been around for a while. Yet again, who can change that? If you got three or four stars on your shoulders, shipmate, that's on you. They can fix it.
Yeah, I want to know where the, you know, I assume we have trashed our Grants and Sheridans and Shermans and, you know, probably a whole bunch of other folks who really when you need them, are the ones that we have to find. And that always takes, historically, we've had the opportunity to find our leaders like that, the Nimitzes and the Pattons and the Eisenhowers and all that. But, you know, a lot of times those guys were low-level officers, but then all of a sudden the war started and they jumped up over a bunch of guys who were pencil pushers.
Well, there you go. You know, some things change. Some things just stay the same. Here's something we kind of talked about in the pre-show. I just realized that we're about to run out of time here. But
I got 2018, plenty of time.
the one thing that I think for the listeners, and again, I could be proven wrong tomorrow morning, but I don't think I will be. One thing that's been sucking a lot of oxygen out of the air that pretty much isn't going to change in the next year, and that's North Korea. I don't see that doing anything but continue to evolve along the path that it is. They're going to keep developing their ballistic missile technology. They're going to keep building mid-20th century nuclear weapons. They're going to be working to get in their targeting better, and we're not going to do a damn thing about it.
Well, not much we can do. I mean, we had the opportunities, I don't know, three or four administrations ago to do more than we did, and there was a lot of talk, but no act, and now it's gotten to the point where it's probably impossible to do anything. So, well, I mean, that really does lead to the way we ought to end this show, and we've got a few extra minutes here.
Sure.
Which is when we're looking ahead, we're looking at 2018, and I've already said that I thought we're going to be looking at these regional hegemons expanding their influence in the areas they want to be hegemonic over. Hegemonic. Anyway, what do you see? We've already talked about Africa a little bit, but what other trend lines do you see that you and I will be discussing as the year unfolds?
Wow. Let's start counterclockwise.
Well, stump the South.
Stump the chump. Well, I think surprisingly what people are going to see is a weakening Russia. The Europeans have slowly and cautiously try to do their best to minimize their reliance on Russia for energy. Incrementally, they're doing that, mostly in the areas of natural gas. As that starts to decrease over time, the amount of reliance they have on Russia, Russia's ability to influence them is going to expand. I think the stalemate in eastern Ukraine and the Crimea, which isn't much of a stalemate, the facts on the ground are what they are, but that's going to continue to be a drain, that frozen conflict, a drain on Russia's resources. People forget Russia only has a GDP half that of California. Again, the Russians are fairly robust and are happy living that way, or at least accepting of it, because they came from such a low position on a per capita basis. But Russia's real-world power and influence, I think, will wane over the course of 2018. Contrary to that, I think the Chinese have a proven record of being more smart than not. And I think equally on an incremental basis, you're going to see China continue to solidify its position as a world player. And I don't think they have any desire to do it at our expense directly, but indirectly they will, by walking into spaces that's in their national interest, to use their influence and their money and their power to be able to get what they consider their rightful place in the world. The big wild card out for me is something we talked about early on in the show, and that's Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's one thing to have regional economic and political conflict, but when you throw in a religious into that same mix, it's just too hard to predict. You've got the Saudis who are insecure, and the Iranians that are perhaps overconfident because of their recent successes. History shows that's a volatile context. If there's going to be any spark to light it more than it already is in Yemen, we just don't know. But I would not be shocked if I woke up in the morning and that whole region was aflame. I also wouldn't be shocked if I woke up 364 days from now and nothing had changed. I just really have no idea.
Yeah. What about Africa? I mean, we've talked about what a mess it is. Where do you see that mess going? I mean, we've got slavery back in the as a result of the Libyan conflict. We've got the ongoing mess that is Nigeria. The Somalia is still a nightmare. South Africa apparently is.
South Africa
in weird ways.
Yeah, South Africa is just dying a slow death like some 19th century tuberculosis person in hospice. I'm Mr. Sunshine here on Africa, I know. There's no, on that entire continent, there's no indication that there's going to be any change in a positive, a little bit with Mugabe being gone, but, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss type of situation going on in Zimbabwe. But there's no indication that you're going to have any change in per capita GDP performance. You're going to have any change on corruption. No change in the rule of law. It's going to be able, and there are little glimmers of hope, but they're being smothered by a demographic and biological festering stew that just is going to smother it. You know, a lot of people talk about Botswana, and when you look at it from a rule of law and other stability-related items, Botswana is doing pretty good. But when you dig into the actual stats, it's riding on the back of the diamond, the world diamond market, that global demographics is not going to support into the future, because young men and women, not just in the U.S. and other places, they don't give a damn about diamonds like they used to. Plus, technology is kind of taking care of the industrial diamond requirements on top of that. People like to talk about Nigeria, but people are always going to talk about Nigeria. Nigeria's problem, it has a religious issue that's not going to go anywhere. And demographically, they're not going to be able to catch their breath, at least not for another generation or two, if they can. And the rest of it is just, you know, it's sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa. And people like to talk about in North Africa, Tunisia. Yet the secular parts of Tunisia are doing their best to stay in power. But people forget, on a per capita basis, more Tunisians fought for the Islamic State than anybody else. And the only thing keeping a lid on Egypt in the upper right-hand corner is the Egyptian military. And your one coup of that going south and headed to the way of Turkey. All I can hope for Africa is that if the Chinese want to play colonial master in Africa, it'll wind up blowing up in their face. We don't need to compete with them. Make friends where we can. Support the people in Botswana trying to do better. Help the South Africans to be more like the Cape Province and less like, you know, KwaZulu-Natal. And there are a couple little tiny little nations here and there that could probably use some help, but you're not going to get past the economic and the corruption parts of that in Africa. I'm extremely pessimistic of it, at least for the next 50 years. And once that's done, I won't be here to worry about it.
Yeah, Chris is pointing out there are some economies that are booming in Africa, and I think I've seen some evidence of that in the West African area. But, you know, those are
some of the smaller countries,
in my mind. Yeah, those are overshadowed by some of the larger issues and the human, you know, we got issues with human migration. I could not believe when I was looking at the data on the migrants who were being picked up off in the Mediterranean, how many of them came from Nigeria and other countries that are just desperate to get to Europe. So, which is the other issue we did not discuss today, but probably ought to. We'll be mentioning down the road is the continuing impact of the human migration that's taken place into Europe. Has Germany accepted all these people? Has Sweden accepted groups of people? And the French, who are facing some tremendous issues, has they accepted, because of their colonial traditions, a bunch of folks? And we see the same thing in England. You know, is there how much breathing room is needed to, if it can be done, to acculturate, is that a good word, these people to the norms of the society in which they have joined? Or is it possible to do that?
And the entering argument there is you have to have a society that demands it. And right now, those that control the levers of power in the UK and Sweden, and it's changing in a couple of other nations and even in Germany, they don't demand assimilation. Immigration is not an issue if it's done in a slow, absorbable way, and the entering argument is assimilation. But that's not what's taking place. Until the Europeans demand assimilations, and we do that as well here, we're better at assimilation than they are. Even though there are some people that continue to push that multiculturalist mentality that does nothing for anybody. If they can get the assimilation right and keep the percentages small enough that it can be absorbed over time, it's no problem. But that's not what's happening. It's at an unsustainable rate, and the governments are not forcing and enforcing assimilation, which is why, just to use one data point, female genital mutilation. In the UK, you're already seeing excuses made for that, permitting child brides being brought in at age 12 and 13 is being looked at the other way. Until they, as a society, decide they're going to demand certain behaviors, not just from native-born citizens, but from those who wish to be citizens, they're going to have trouble.
Yes, they are, and I suspect we'll be talking about that, and as they used to say on some radio show I listened to, and a great deal more over the coming year. Look, we need to let our listeners go, and I want to thank all of them for joining us over the last year, 7 years, and we're going to continue on plotting on with these shows for the next. For the foreseeable future, and we're glad you joined us, and I'd like to wish you all a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and the best of all possible New Year's.
Absolutely, and I'll look forward for our 8th year starting in the new year, and thank you very much, everybody, for joining us, for Midrats, to listen to us prattle on, and until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
And take care, everybody.
Reply to Irish Paddy, oh, saying, Mike, my lord.